This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
On our current path, by the end of this century, Earth could warm over 4 degrees C, way past the danger point. We know that from ingenious work out of Carnegie Institution for Science at Stanford University. Dr. Patrick T. Brown is the lead author of the new paper in Nature, along with his co-author Ken Caldera. The paper is setting a fire in science. I've talked to several scientists about it already. It's only been out a couple of days. It's very bad news about our future unless we slash emissions fast. Patrick is a postdoctoral research scientist. Since getting his doctorate in 2016, he's published 7 refereed scientific papers. Patrick is also a contributor to the fact-checking website Climate Feedback. Patrick Brown, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
It's important to get this new science out through nonprofit radio, so let's get to it. In 2016, you wrote an article in Physics Today explaining how different views of the same facts could provide more or less sensational headlines. How is this for a sensational headline from the usually reliable MIT Technology Review? It says, a new study based on satellite observations finds that temperatures could rise nearly 5 degrees C by the end of this century. Patrick, can we find that in your new paper in Nature?
Yeah, you can find that. The issue there, though, is that that assumes a given increase in greenhouse gases from humans. And so humans still have the choices to make. So humans can emit less greenhouse gases, and then that those numbers would come down. So our results are, for a given increase in greenhouse gases, this is what we would expect in terms of temperature. But we're not saying anything about we're not trying to predict the future of how technology and how human decisions will progress over the next century. So that's where the real changes can come in.
What drove you and Ken to do this research?
Well, this has just been a longstanding question in climate science of, for a given increase in greenhouse gases, how much warming do we expect? And it's been a stubbornly large range for a long time. And so that's why it was something that we were interested in looking at. And so we have these new observations that are just kind of coming to maturity over the past 10 to 15 years. So now we have 15 years of really good satellite data, which is kind of just starting to get long enough to get robust statistics on these types of things. And so we wanted to use that to see if we could really discriminate between the well and poor performing models and then see if the better models projected a different amount of warming in the future than the average model. And so what we found is that the models that are doing the best in simulating the recent past where we have good observations are the models that tend to simulate more warming in the future.
For many of us, the crash of sea ice in 2007 came as a shock. Was that projected by climate models at the time?
Well, not explicitly, but you can expect models to predict year-to-year variability like that. You can only expect them to predict long-term trends. So like the fact that sea ice crashed in 2007 rather than 2010 or 2005, that's something that's just kind of random and has to do with just the chaotic nature of the climate system. And it's not something that any climate model will ever be able to project. But climate models in general do show this long-term decrease in Arctic sea ice. And that is something that we have seen in observations as well.
But it does suggest that there could be other big surprises that models don't see.
Absolutely. There could definitely be tipping points in the climate system that could come about in a very short amount of time and be a big surprise to climate scientists.
Do we know why some models are working better than others?
Well, that's something that our research is trying to address. So most of the range in future warming comes from the way that models treat clouds. Clouds are very difficult to model, and there's a lot of uncertainty in terms of how clouds will change as the Earth gets warmer. So some models say that as the Earth gets warmer, there'll be less cloud coverage, and so that will reflect less solar radiation back to space, which would mean we'll absorb more of that sunlight, and that would cause further warming. So that would be a positive cloud feedback. Where some models suggest that as the Earth gets warmer, cloud coverage will actually increase, and that will reflect more of the sun's energy back to space, and so that would cancel out some of the warming. And so what we're finding is that the models that project this positive feedback, not positive in the normative sense, but positive as in it amplifies the initial warming, models that produce this positive cloud feedback are the ones that are doing the best in the in simulating the recent past. And so it seems like they are simulating the clouds the best over the time period when we have observations. And so there's reason to believe that their simulation of cloud feedback in the future will also be the best.
So there has been a difference in projections, and let's be clear about the models you're assessing. Are we talking about the best coupled models, the most complicated, the best we have internationally?
Yes, there's about 30 or 40 global climate models that are produced by different organizations all around the world, and they are the state-of-the-art, cutting-edge models in terms of simulating the entire Earth climate system.
Some people have accused the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change as erring on the side of caution, and of course they do have to report to governments. Has the IPCC picked very conservative models?
No, not in my estimation. I think the IPCC has done a very fair survey of the literature. So one thing that they are doing, though, is that they're basically adhering to this principle of kind of model democracy. So if you develop a model and it's, you know, it meets the standards and then it gets submitted to these kind of data archives, that will be included in the IPCC. And there's no kind of discrimination between models that are performing well and models that are not performing so well. So that's something that our research is attempting to do. But I wouldn't say that the IPCC has intentionally erred on the side of caution. I think it's a very fair survey of the literature.
And you begin in the paper by naming two great sources of uncertainty in these models, and maybe you've already discussed one of them, which is what are humans going to do and what will our emissions be, but what are the other uncertainties that you looked at?
Yeah, so that's the first uncertainty is what are humans going to do, and then the kind of the second line of uncertainty is there's carbon cycle feedback uncertainties, so that humans might increase greenhouse gases, and then that could cause further increases in greenhouse gases. That's another thing that we didn't really look at. So our study was just on this issue of if you define ahead of time how much increase in greenhouse gases that you're supposing will happen in the future, then how much temperature change do you get? And so that uncertainty is what we're looking at. And that uncertainty has a lot to do with clouds. And so as I mentioned, it's the models that are simulating the clouds the best in the recent past tend to simulate more warming in the future. And we think that we can narrow that uncertainty using our statistical analysis.
And what about climate sensitivity? Are you including that as a response uncertainty?
Yeah, so we explicitly, the majority of our results are for these future greenhouse gas concentration pathways. But we also do look at climate sensitivity itself. And so our results say that the raw model mean, if you just throw all the models together and average them, climate sensitivity, which is the amount of warming you get for doubling CO2 concentrations and then allowing the climate system to equilibrate, the amount of warming that you get for all the models, if you just average them together, is 3.1 degrees Celsius. And our results, combining information from models and observations, suggests an equilibrium climate sensitivity of 3.7 degrees Celsius.
I've heard Dr. James Hansen talk about Earth's radiative energy budget. How would you explain that for the ordinary person? Because I think it's important that we get what that's about in order to understand your paper.
Yeah, so basically, if you're thinking about temperature, temperature is more or less a measure of energy. And the energy for the climate system comes from the sun, and it's just kind of a basic accounting. We call it a budget, just like a family budget, where you have flows of energy coming in from the sun, so light coming in from the sun. But part of that energy is not absorbed by the Earth system. It's reflected back to space right away by things like clouds or things like ice and snow on the surface of the planet. And so you would have kind of a positive flow coming in from the sun, and then you would subtract out what's reflected back to space, similar to income and expenditure in a budget. And then the other big component of the budget is that the Earth itself is emitting radiation to space. So it's just like light, except it's at a longer wavelength. And so it's sometimes called heat radiation or infrared radiation or long wave radiation. But the Earth is emitting that to space. And that also interacts with clouds and with these greenhouse gases in our atmosphere. And so you have to do the accounting on the energy flows over there as well. But fundamentally, temperature, the temperature of the planet and then temperature change of the planet has to do with how these energy flows change in the Earth's climate system. So it's the whole global warming scientific issue is all about the Earth's energy budget.
And what comes back from the satellites that you were able to use to get a grasp on what's happening now?
Yeah, so we're looking at, we're using this instrument called the Ceres, or it's not an instrument, it's really just a system because it's on multiple satellites. But it's an instrument that's looking at the radiation coming back from the Earth to space. So it can sample both the reflected shortwave radiation coming back, so the sun's light reflected back to space, and it can also see the heat radiation or the infrared radiation. And so that satellite has allowed us to basically constrain what the Earth's energy budget is over this time period, at least starting in around 2001. And before that, we had some less reliable estimates. And then before the 70s, before there were satellites, it was extremely difficult to know anything about what the Earth's energy budget was doing on a year-to-year or decade-to-decade basis.
Patrick, just out of curiosity, did your internships with NASA help you understand what is possible with satellites?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I was at JPL for two summers, and they are kind of at the center of this Earth system observation area. And so being exposed to many seminars and many other scientists' work there has absolutely helped me understand how we can best use these satellites to understand our climate system better.
I find in the paper's discussion on physical mechanisms, you mentioned, quote, the efficiency by which energy is distributed to the deeper layers of the ocean. How important is that to our overall picture of the coming climate, and do we really understand that variable fully?
Yeah, so that's kind of a throwaway line in the paper, because we don't explicitly look at that aspect of it in our paper, but that is very important because the Earth's heat capacity is mostly in the ocean, and depending on how much of the ocean is available to absorb that heat, that will matter a lot in terms of how much warming you get for a given increase in greenhouse gases. So if most of the heat is absorbed in the upper layers of the ocean and stays there, that's bad news for people living on the surface of the planet, like everyone, because we're very close to that heat. However, if the ocean is able to distribute that heat to depth more readily, that would mean that less heat would be staying at the surface where we live. And so you'd expect less warming there, and then, of course, less negative impacts that are projected. So that's a key aspect of the science, and a lot of oceanographers are working on that. We think we have that constrained within a relatively narrow range, such that that new answers are not going to radically change our projections of warming. But that is a key aspect that people are looking at.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. Patrick Brown from the Carnegie Institution at Stanford. We're talking about his new paper in the journal Nature and a climate that may be at the worst end of prediction, depending on how we react to the situation. On a current trajectory of emissions, the business-as-usual RCP 8.5 of the IPCC, what percent chance, Patrick, would an ensemble of major climate models give of going over 4 degrees C mean warming?
So in our results, we show that under the RCP 8.5 scenario, if you just look at the raw models without incorporating observations, there would be about a 62% chance of exceeding 4 degrees Celsius, where when you incorporate information from observations like we're doing, it would be a 93% chance. So upping that chance of going over that threshold, which of course is, you know, twice what the Paris Agreement would have us be looking at. So that is not where we want to be.
I don't like those odds. There were two conferences called Beyond 4 Degrees, and the scientists there thought that at the time that it was unthinkable and maybe unsurvivable. So, yeah, we got to make some changes before we go there.
Right. Based on the literature on impacts, which is not what my study is about, but based on that literature, we do not want to be going down the RCP 8.5 pathway, which is basically a continue to emit more and more greenhouse gases throughout the century pathway.
Now, on your bio page at Carnegie, you like quantifying difficult to quantify things. I tried to follow the formulas in your new paper, and my science isn't good enough. I failed. Can you give us an example of maybe one of the difficult to quantify things that you explored when you were trying to compare the models to reality, let's say?
I would say that the whole practice is trying to quantify a difficult to quantify thing. So we're trying to, you know, in the most complete and best way possible, use our best observations to basically decipher between well and poor performing models. And we think that we did a pretty good job of that. So like one, just to give like a specific example of what's going on in our methodology that's attempting to quantify a difficult to quantify thing, we look at, say, the average amount of clouds in a given location and how that relates to warming in the future. So some models simulate more clouds in the current climate system, and those models, in certain locations anyway, those models tend to simulate more warming because they have more clouds that can dissipate in the future. So the more clouds in the current climate system lead to more dissipation, which means to more absorption of solar radiation in the future, and thus more warming. So those types of mechanisms are what are revealed by our study.
Here's another worrying little note from the discussion part of the new paper. You write, a rapid nonlinear melting of the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets has some plausibility, but is not represented in any of the models studied here. So we're not even officially looking at the possible very worst case scenarios.
That's correct. So the starting point for our study is to basically assume that the range of the climate models and the range of the future warming from these climate models is representative of, you know, the possible futures. And that's, we know that that's not totally the case because, for example, like I say, none of the models do anything like that in terms of a rapid melting of the Antarctic ice sheet. But if you talk to glaciologists, they would tell you that that is not a possibility that should be totally dismissed. That it's a possibility that should be considered seriously. It's just that in these models at the current time frame, they're not sophisticated enough to be able to simulate these types of ice sheet dynamics in a very sophisticated manner. So the fact that that's left out from the models means that that is not included in our statistical analysis either. And so that's just a caveat that has to be out there, that we're not really fully sampling all of the range of possibilities that could come in the future.
When I talk to scientists who are optimistic, they're going for the IPCC pathway called RCP 4.5, and that's where we do take some significant actions to reduce emissions relatively quickly. But then you found even that trajectory could give us warming greater than what is in the IPCC reports. Is that right?
Yeah. So for any given trajectory, we basically show more warming than what would be calculated by just using the raw model results, which is what the IPCC does. So it doesn't matter if it's a very, very steep future emissions pathway or a more stringent pathway, we would show that in both cases, we would expect more warming than what has previously been calculated.
I noticed that climate change deniers and some business opportunists demeaned climate models because they didn't correctly capture some parts of reality. Given your research, what happens to that argument?
Yeah, so that's an argument that's made a lot. That people say that, well, because climate models don't do a perfect job of simulating the recent past when we have observations to compare them to, that means that we can probably dismiss the most, severe projections of global warming in the future. But our research really turns that on its head, because what we're showing is that the models that do the best in simulating the recent past when we have observations to compare them to, those are the models that actually simulate the most warming in the future, or the most severe projections of global warming. So that means that our results say that if you wanted to kind of throw out the models that are doing the worst, that would mean that you're going to suggest that future warming will be worse than expected, not less severe than expected.
After your research, are you prepared to recommend certain climate models as being the best to be looking at?
I would say that you can potentially look at certain climate models as being the best for a given problem. So climate models do a lot of things other than project global average temperature. So a model that might be better at projecting global average temperature in the future might be worse at projecting sea ice decline, or it might be worse at projecting drought or something like that. So I think you have to, I wouldn't say that there are some models that are just bad. There's just some models that are better at given applications than others.
Are there some things that climate modelers can do now that they've got your paper and this information to improve what they're doing?
Yeah, I think the community has been working on for a long time, and it will continue to work on these cloud parameterizations. And hopefully our paper will point people in the direction of at least the geographic locations where cloud simulations can be improved the most. And thus, that will help improve our projections in the raw model results in the future.
I think this is something that's outside your paper. I know that it is, but it's something we all have to ask ourselves personally. Do you think civilization can survive a 5-degree warming of global mean temperatures by the end of this century?
I, as a physical climate scientist, I will have to just lead ignorance to that question, because it's really an impacts question. It's really a question of, how crops will be able to weather a warming like that, how ecosystem services would change, how society in general would be able to adapt to that. And those are things that are so far out of my range of expertise that I just feel like that it would just be pure speculation for me to talk about.
Fair enough. I want to ask you as we wrap up, what do we still need to find out? What are you going to be working on next?
Well, actually, I am very interested in this question of how, basically what you just brought up, of when we increase the temperature of the planet from emitting greenhouse gases, that has a negative impact on society, which can be measured in, for example, integrated assessment models that incorporate the negative economic impact of that. And then that can be weighed against any potential negative impacts from trying to reduce emissions by essentially making energy more expensive by, forcing the switch to renewable energies. In some cases, making energy more expensive, which makes basically everything more expensive. So I think that type of calculation is what's most relevant for informing policy and for looking down the road in terms of human-environment interaction. And so I am very interested in continuing research in that area, where you're looking at human-environment interaction in terms of the global climate and the economy, and how to do that kind of cost-benefit analysis in the best way, such that we can make a future that's kind of the best for everyone.
From California, we've been speaking with Dr. Patrick Brown from the Carnegie Institution for Science at Stanford. He's the lead author of a new paper titled Greater Future Global Warming Inferred from Earth's Recent Energy Budget, as published in the journal Nature, December 7, 2017. Get the links and details in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Patrick, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot. It's been great.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.